Hello and welcome to the September 2015 IFRIC Update podcast. My name is Michael Stewart, Director of Implementation Activities at the ISB, and I'm joined today by Takashi Yamagami, Javed Dosani, and Bernadette Wittig to talk about some of the issues that were discussed by the Interpretations Committee when they met on the 8th and 9th of September. Now, the views that you'll hear presented in this podcast will be those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the Interpretations Committee or the ISB. The full details of the proceedings of the Interpretations Committee can be found in the IFRIC Update newsletter available on the ISB website. Now, the first issues that we want to talk about today relate to IFRS 5, which is the standard on non-current assets held for sale and discontinued operations. Now, Takashi, there were a number of issues that were discussed relating to IFRS 5. Perhaps if we could start with the one related to impairment or allocation of impairment losses.
Okay.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the issue is and what the concerns were that were raised?
Okay, sure. So the first issue relates to a measurement requirement of IFRS 5. Specifically, it relates to whether an impairment loss recognized for a disposal group can be allocated to non-current assets in the group that are within the scope of the management requirements of IFRS 5, to the extent that such an allocation reduces the carrying amount of such assets below their fair value less cost to sell or value in use. So this concern was raised because paragraph 23 of IFRS 5, which sets out the requirements for the allocation of impairment loss, includes a reference to paragraph 104 of IS 36, but not paragraph 105. Paragraph 104 relates to allocation of impairment loss, and paragraph 105 relates to the extent of impairment loss allocation. Given this, there was a concern relating to the applicability of paragraph 105 when an entity allocates impairment losses to non-current assets in accordance with IFRS 5.
And what was the view of the Interpretations Committee on this issue, and what has it decided or proposed to do?
So during the discussion of this issue, the Interpretations Committee noted that this issue was limited to the measurement of non-current assets that are within the scope of the measurement requirements of IFRS 5, and that the way to allocate losses to such assets is prescribed in paragraph 23 of IFRS 5. The Interpretations Committee also noted that paragraph 23 refers to paragraphs 104 and 122 of IS 36 in determining the order of allocation of impairment losses to such assets, but it does not include a reference to paragraph 105. Consequently, the Interpretations Committee observed that paragraph 105 would not affect the allocation of an impairment loss recognized for disposal group to non-current assets that are within the scope of the measurement requirements of IFRS 5. The Interpretations Committee understood this to mean that the amount of impairment that should be recognized for disposal group would not be restricted by the fair value less cost for disposal or value in use of those assets. There were also some comments from some Interpretations Committee members that no limitation of impairment allocation within this context would be consistent with what they thought was the unit of account for the purpose of the IFRS 5 measurement, which is the disposal group. Based on the discussion, they concluded that there was sufficient guidance with respect to this issue and decided to publish a tentative agenda decision for the comments.
Okay, so what will be the next steps?
We will publish in the upcoming IFRIC update a tentative agenda decision for comments, summarizing the discussion and observations made during the meeting. After receiving and analyzing comments on the decision, we will bring a paper to the Interpretations Committee at a future meeting.
And of course, that tentative agenda decision will be open for comment for 60 days.
Yes.
And another one of the IFRS 5 issues that the committee looked at was related to the presentation of intragroup transactions between continuing and discontinued operations. Takashi, can you tell us a little bit about what this issue related to and what the concerns were that people had raised?
Yes. So the issue is, as you said, relates to whether and how to eliminate transactions between continuing and discontinued operations on the face of the income statement, especially when there are significant transactions between them and the continuing operation expects that such a relationship will continue after the disposal activity. So this concern was raised because while paragraph 30 of IFRS 5 is clear that it requires provision of useful information in assessing the financial effects of discontinued operations, it seems that there is not a specific guidance on the presentation of intragroup transactions between continuing and discontinued operations. The submitter of this issue claimed that there was diversity in practice in how companies present such transactions in the income statement. Practices observed include full elimination of intragroup transactions before determining the presentation of continuing and discontinued operations, elimination of transactions with some adjustments to reflect future relationship with the discontinued operations, and no elimination at all.
So what did the Interpretations Committee, what was their view on this? So what has it decided to do?
So after discussing the issue, the Interpretations Committee noted that there are no requirements or guidance in IFRS 5 or IS 1 in relation to the presentation of discontinued operations that override the consolidation requirements in IFRS 10. Therefore, the Interpretations Committee observed that normal consolidation requirements in IFRS 10 would apply in the situation considered. The Interpretations Committee also noted that paragraph B86C of IFRS 10 requires eliminations of, among other things, income and expenses relating to intergroup transactions and not merely intergroup profit. The members of the Interpretations Committee understood this to mean that an entity needs to eliminate intergroup sales against the internal selling party and intergroup purchases against the internal purchasing party. There were some concerns, though, among the members that a presentation in the income statement reflecting full elimination in such a way may not always lead to the most relevant information to the users. Nevertheless, they thought that the requirements of current IFRS are clear and such elimination has to occur. They noted that if additional information is necessary to enable users to understand the financial effects of discontinued operations, an entity has to provide additional information in the notes in accordance with paragraph 30 of IFRS 5. Based on the discussion, they concluded that in the light of the existing requirements of IFRS 5, sufficient guidance exists and decided to publish a tentative agenda decision for comments.
And of course, some of these discussions, when looking at the alternative presentations, I know some of the committee members did raise concerns about a what-if presentation if the entity tried to present what they thought the results would look like if they had been separated but continued to trade from the continuing to the discontinued operation. And that potentially raises questions about pro forma information, etc. So, okay, the committee's decided to publish a tentative agenda decision, and the next steps now would be the same as the other one, so 60-day comment period, and then we bring it back at a future meeting.
Yes.
Great, thank you. For our next issue, we turn to the topic of IFRS 11 and joint arrangements. And Javed, can you tell us about what the issue is that was submitted to us?
Yes, Michael. So the committee had received a request to address whether or not previously held interest should be remeasured in a particular transaction. And as they discussed that transaction, they had observed that it would be useful to analyze other transactions as well simultaneously with the fact pattern that had been submitted. So at this meeting, they discussed the accounting for previously held interest for the transaction that they had decided to include within the scope of their project. For the purposes of this discussion, we'll focus on two particular transactions for which the committee tentatively decided to recommend some amendments in the form of annual improvements.
Okay. You mentioned two particular transactions. What's the first one we're going to look at?
Yeah, so the first transaction was one where an entity is either a joint operator in a joint operation or they're a party to the joint operation, but they have rights to the assets and obligations for the liabilities. And subsequent to the transaction, they actually obtain control of this joint operation. And the question was, and this joint operation meets the definition for business, the question was whether the previously held interest in the assets and liabilities need to be remeasured when control is obtained. So there were divergent views on this, and with some proponents saying that previously held interest should be remeasured because this represents a significant economic event, it's a business combination, and the requirements of IFRS 3 require remeasurement of previously held interest. On the other hand, some other proponents thought that the remeasurement requirements in IFRS 3, because they refer to remeasurement of what the standard refers to as equity interest, and because this is a joint operation, they argued that there is no real equity interest in a joint operation, and therefore the remeasurement requirements do not apply in this case.
Okay, and so this is a joint operation where the joint operation is not structured through a separate legal entity.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And so what did the Interpretations Committee decide in respect of this transaction?
Yeah, so the committee members observed that the transaction represents a significant economic event, and their discussion centered around the fact that IFRS 3 requires remeasurement of previously held interest when there's a significant economic event. And because this was a gain of control, they observed that the remeasurement requirements should be applicable in this scenario. They also observed that this would be the case whether or not the joint operation was structured through a legal entity or not. But they did note that the current wording in paragraph 41 and 42, which specifically refer to equity interest, could be interpreted to imply that the previously held interests do not have to be remeasured. So therefore, they decided as the next step to recommend an amendment to paragraph 41-42 of IFRS 3 to clarify that the remeasurement requirements would also be applicable when control is obtained over a joint operation.
Okay, so there might have been, debate really about whether or not this is a significant economic event. The standards are pretty clear on that. Obtaining control is a significant economic
event.
The question here was, because it wasn't structured through an entity, then was the remeasurement of previously held equity interests limited only to conventional equity interests,
correct,
or could it be more broadly interpreted?
Correct.
And the committee's taken a broader interpretation here.
Correct.
Okay.
That's absolutely correct.
And you mentioned there were two transactions. What's the second one?
Yes, so the second transaction was actually the original submission, and that was a scenario where an entity was a party to a joint operation. They had rights to the assets and obligations for the liabilities, and therefore accounted for their rights in the assets and obligations and the liabilities directly. And subsequent to the transaction, they actually acquire some additional interest in that joint operation and become a joint operator in that joint operation. Again, in this scenario, the asset or the group of assets meets the definition of a business. And similar to the previous transaction that we discussed, there were differing views on whether or not the previously held interest in the assets and liabilities should be remeasured, because some read the wordings in basis of conclusion, paragraph 45M of IFRS 11, to say that acquisition of interest in a joint operation is similar to acquisition of control in a business. And therefore, they read this as implying that the requirements for remeasurement in IFRS 3 would also be applicable, while others viewed this transaction as being more analogous to an investment in a joint investment in an associate, where it then becomes an investment in a joint venture. And the board in IS 28 has clearly stated that the previously held interest should not be remeasured. So there were those two divergent opinions on this transaction as well.
Okay, so unlike the previous transaction where everybody felt it was clear that obtaining control is a significant economic event, here there was perhaps some debate about whether or not obtaining joint control,
correct,
was a significant economic event,
that's
or at least
correct,
sufficiently significant to trigger remeasurement.
That's exactly correct.
So where did the Interpretations Committee get to with this one?
So the Interpretations Committee observed that this transaction is more analogous to one where an investment in an associate becomes an investment in a joint venture. And while it may be significant, it's not at the same level of significance as one where control is obtained and one that would trigger the requirements to remeasure. And therefore, the committee member's view was that in this scenario, remeasurement would not be applicable and the previously held interest should not be remeasured. They also observed that this would be consistent with the requirements of IFRS 11, which require an entity to account for the assets and liabilities of the joint operation in accordance with the applicable IFRS standards. But again, similar to the previous transaction, they observed that the wording in IFRS 11 is not very clear and could provide a technical basis for people to conclude that remeasurement is required in this scenario. And therefore, they again decided to recommend an amendment to IFRS 11 to clarify that the previously held interest should not be remeasured.
Okay, good. Thank you. So our next issue relates to IAS 39 financial instruments, and in particular, an item about the separation of an embedded interest rate floor from a floating rate host contract in a negative interest rate environment. Now, Bernadette, what can you tell us about this issue?
Okay, so the issue is that under IAS 39, an embedded derivative is required to be separated from the host contract and accounted for as a derivative if the economic characteristics and risks of that embedded derivative are not closely related to those of the host contract. And so an interest rate floor is a common form of embedded derivative, which is often placed in debt instruments. And paragraph AG 33B of IAS 39 provides specific guidance around when such a floor is considered not to be closely related to the host debt contract. And essentially, this paragraph requires an interest rate floor to be separated from the host contract if the floor is above the market rate of interest when the contract is issued, even if the floor is not leveraged. And so this basically means that if the intrinsic value of the floor is positive, it must be split out and accounted for as a separate derivative. And so the submitter has queried the appropriate application of these requirements in a negative interest rate environment where interest rate floors have become more common. They identified two alternative views regarding the appropriate accounting treatment. The first view is that paragraph AG 33B of IAS 39 should be implied as it would in a positive interest rate environment, and therefore when the floor is above the market rate of interest, it should be separated. And the second view is that the embedded floor should not be separated because negative interest is considered to be a special case, and that is that it represents a fee rather than interest, and is simply a sensible commercial pricing mechanism to prevent lenders having to pay borrowers.
Now, this issue, like all the issues that we look at, we first think about how widespread the issue is and whether there's diversity in practice. What did we learn about how widespread or how diverse practice is from our outreach with regards to this issue?
So in terms of whether the issue is widespread, the overall feedback from our outreach suggested that it wasn't yet widespread. And in fact, many respondents had observed that they hadn't really come across this issue. But some respondents did note that the issue had arisen, especially in certain European jurisdictions. Then coming to diversity in practice, the results of the outreach indicated some degree of diversity in practice, but the predominant accounting treatment was not to separate out the embedded derivative. And in support of that treatment, some argued that negative interest was a special case, and so that was similar to the second view presented by the submitter, whereas others argued that the market rate of interest referred to in paragraph AG 33B of IAS 39 should be understood to mean the rate of interest which includes applicable credit and other spreads.
And what was the committee's view on this issue?
And so the committee, first of all, discussed whether the requirements of paragraph AG 33B of IAS 39 should apply in a negative interest rate environment, or whether negative interest rates should be considered a special case. And while a number of members questioned the economic nature of negative interest, they noted that in accordance with IAS 39, there was no distinction made between positive and negative interest rates. And consequently, the requirements of paragraph AG 33B should be applied in the same way as it would for a positive interest rate environment. And the committee then also considered how the market rate of interest, which is referred to in IAG 33B, should be determined. And in this regard, they noted that the term market rate of interest is used in a number of other areas throughout IAS 39 and is linked to the concept of fair value. Therefore, they considered that in order to determine the appropriate market rate of interest when the contract is issued for the purposes of applying that paragraph, an entity should consider the specific terms of the contract, including the relevant credit or other spreads appropriate for the counterparty and the market in which it is operating. And so overall, the committee noted that there was sufficient guidance within IFRS in respect of both the requirements to separate an embedded interest rate floor from a host debt contract in a negative interest rate environment, and also in respect of how the market rate of interest should be determined. And consequently, the committee tentatively decided not to add this issue onto its agenda.
Okay, and so what will be the next steps now for this project?
And so in terms of next steps, the tentative agenda decision will be open for comments for 60 days, and then the committee will discuss the comments at a future meeting.
Okay, thank you. So sticking with financial instruments, but this time looking at IFRS 9 and also IAS 28, the Investments and Associates Standards, the next issue we're going to talk about now relates to the impairment of long-term interest. Now, Bernadette, can you just describe what this issue is about?
Yeah. Yes, and so this issue relates to the interaction between IAS 28 and IFRS 9 in the context of long-term interests in an associate or joint venture, and those long-term interests which would otherwise be wholly within the scope of IFRS 9. And so an example of an unsecured long-term loan or receivable for which settlement is unlikely in the foreseeable future and which is considered in substance to be part of the net investment. And so the issue is that Paragraph 2.1a of IFRS 9 scopes out interests in associates and joint ventures that are accounted for in accordance with IAS 28, but doesn't go into any further detail regarding what is meant by an interest. So it is not immediately clear whether a long-term interest of this nature should be considered to form part of that interest. However, IAS 28 contains additional references which are relevant. So first of all, it notes that in only interests in associates and joint ventures that are accounted for using the equity method are outside the scope of IFRS 9. It also makes specific reference to long-term interests which in substance form part of the net investment, noting that they should be considered to form part of the interest in an associate or joint venture in the context of the allocation of losses. And finally, it also contains specific impairment requirements pertaining to that net investment, requiring the entire carrying amount of the investment to be tested for impairment in accordance with IAS 36 and where there is objective evidence that that net investment is impaired. And so, for example, in the case of a long-term interest in the form of an interest-bearing loan, which would otherwise be wholly within the scope of IFRS 9, the question arises as to whether the accounting should be governed by IFRS 9, IAS 28 or a combination of both standards. And consequently, the question raised by the submitter is whether the scope exemption from IFRS 9 relating to interests in associates and joint ventures should be interpreted to include such a long-term interest. And that's in particular in the context of the impairment requirements. And this question becomes more important with the introduction of the new expected credit loss model under IFRS 9, as this is a very different impairment model to the incurred loss impairment model in IAS 28 and IAS 36.
Okay, so thinking first of all about how common this issue is, what do we know about how widespread it is, and in particular about diversity in practice?
Yes, so the feedback we received from our outreach did indicate that there was both diversity in practice and that the issue was widespread. Many respondents commented that the requirements were unclear and considered that a number of different accounting treatments were possible. And to give you a flavour, for example, some considered that the long-term interest could be entirely within the scope of IFRS 9 and therefore subject to the expected credit loss impairment model. Entirely within the scope of IFRS 9, but also within the scope of IAS 28 for impairment, and therefore subject to two different impairment models. Or alternatively, not within the scope of IFRS 9 at all, and instead accounted for using the equity method in accordance with IAS 28. And lastly, others considered that it may be within the scope of IFRS 9 for classification and measurement purposes, excluding impairment, and then within the scope of IAS 28 for impairment. So there was no real doubt that there was diversity in practice.
Okay, and what did the committee say about this? What were their view?
So the committee acknowledged that the feedback received from the outreach indicated that there were very divergent views on how to account for the impairment of long-term interest, and also noted the widespread nature of the issue. They also discussed the interaction of the requirements between IFRS 9 and IAS 28 in relation to long-term interests, and in their view the requirements were unclear. And in light of this, they considered that an amendment to IFRS would be required in order to clarify the interaction of the requirements between these two standards in the context of long-term interests, and therefore they decided that they would add this issue to their agenda.
Okay, and so what do we expect the next steps to be?
So the next steps really will be that the staff will present a paper at a future meeting, and that paper will explore the issue in more detail in order to determine the most appropriate way forward, and that may well be a potential amendment to IAS 28.
Okay, thank you. That brings us to the end of our September 2015 IFRIC Update podcast. And just a reminder that the views that you've heard will be those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the Interpretations Committee or the ISB. And that the full details of the proceedings of the Interpretations Committee meeting can be found in the IFRIC Update newsletter on the ISB website. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.